You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Tom Clavin.
Thanks for tuning in to Author Stories. We've got a fantastic show for you today. But before we get into that, I'd like to tell you about a couple of sponsors who make the show possible each and every day. Craig Allinson has a brand new book. It's a spinoff of the Expeditionary Force series, Expeditionary Force Mavericks Book 1, Death Trap. The human soldiers stranded on the planet Paradise have been recruited into an alien legion to do the dirty jobs that the high-tech species won't do. Their first mission is to kick the enemy off a backwater planet no one cares about. It's a simple assignment, except everyone has a hidden agenda, and the planet could become a death trap. Craig Allinson's brand new book, Death Trap. Also thanks to Ernie Lindsay with his Sarah series, the psychological thriller series that begins with Sarah, has books 1-3 and a bonus novella, Single Mother, Successful Executive, Target for Revenge. The psychological thriller series box sets Sarah Winthrop's world is thrown headlong into a whirlwind of chaos, along with her family, friends, and colleagues, by unseen enemies seeking revenge. Those lurking in the shadows, clawing for vengeance, will go to any lengths. Any lengths. It's likely never occurred to them that they may have just messed with the wrong woman. The Sarah series, books 1-3 and a bonus novella by Ernie Lindsay. Also, John L. Monk with the Jenkins Cycle, from book 1, Kick, a supernatural thriller. They say suicides are damned for eternity, but if possessing the bodies of violent criminals is hell, then Dan Jenkins will take it, and he does, every time a portal arrives to whisk him from his ghostly exile. Normally, before the villain returns to kick him out, Dan dishes out a final serving of justice and leaves the world a safer place. It's one of the rules if he wants more rides, and he's happy to oblige. For a part-time dead guy, it's a pretty good gig. And then he meets her. Kick is the first book in a series of supernatural thrillers. If you like Quantum Leap and Everyday, you'll love this gritty and original take on the body-hopping hero story. Vividly written, Kick is a wild ride with a sharp, sarcastic wit and a flawed yet likable main character. From John L. Monk, The Jenkins Cycle, Book 1, Kick. And from M.D. Massey, Invasion, Zombie Apocalypse. The action-packed first novel in M.D. Massey's Them Zombie Apocalypse series. When a surprise nuclear attack forces Aiden from hiding, he finds the world to be a much different place and more deadly. Now he'll traverse a post-apocalyptic landscape populated by violent redneck looters, rogue military factions, and an army of hungry undead. After two combat tours in the Middle East, Aiden Sullivan just wants to be left alone on his family's ranch in the Texas Hill Country. But when the bombs fall and the dead walk, Aiden risks life and limb to rescue his aging parents from the zombie horde. To save them, he'll traverse half the state of Texas while fighting rogue military units, violent redneck looters, and thousands of walking dead. The question is, can he make it there in time? Only one thing's for sure, this ranger will complete the mission or he'll die trying. M.D. Massey's Invasion, Zombie Apocalypse. Now on to our show. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Tom Clavin on the show with me today. He has a fantastic new book called Wild Bill, The True Story of the American Frontier's First Gunfighter. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to talking to you.
I'm looking forward to talking with you, too. It seems like we have a couple of mutual friends that I saw in the email exchange that you and Don had, so excited to chat with you today.
Sure.
Yeah. Tom, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, it probably is my first memory is that before I ever went to school, my mother taught me how to read and write. So I was probably reading basic stories when I was 3 years old and writing sentences. And I think that experience of discovering words and stories and their possibilities at such a young age, and I probably coupled with getting all this attention from my mother, who at that time, you know, this being a stay-at-home mother was fairly typical, I think, you know, planted that seed in me that I want to try and do something with words and with stories at some point in my life. And that only got that feeling only got deeper and more urgent as I got older, to where I was writing short stories when I was 11 or 12 years old, banging them out on a manual typewriter, and always wanting to be published. That didn't mean that things just fell into place because I wanted them to, but it was something I had to persevere at. But it really dated back. You know, I can almost say I can't remember a time when I did not want to write.
Right. Did you, all those years that you spent on the manual typewriter pounding out those short stories, did you have the idea?
Hello?
Tom?
Yes.
No, sorry about that. My mic was muted. I apologize.
Okay.
All that time that you spent on the manual typewriter pounding out those stories, did you have the idea, the inkling that this was something that you were doing to hone your craft? Did you realize that each time that you were doing this, that you were getting better and better? What was it, a trajectory for you that you realized?
Well, yes and no. I wasn't on any path that I had planned out. I just felt this compulsion to tell stories. So it wasn't something that was any kind of strategy on my part. I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do this, and at some point I'm going to be a real writer. However, I did feel that each time that I wrote something, that I finished something, that I was a little bit better at it. Now, sometimes there'd be a step back, but where I thought, oh, that wasn't any better than the last one, or it was even worse. Well, I got out of my system. Now let's try to write something better. So yeah, I'm a big believer in, you know, to be a writer, you have to keep writing. And you know, there's wonderful things to say about classroom study and about degrees in writing and everything like that. And I certainly don't disparage them. But I think if you don't have that bottom line of actually writing, and so I found that out by just doing and doing and doing, and eventually, you know, yes, as you put it, honing the craft. That's right. I consider writing very much a craft. I mean, it can be an art. When you talk about somebody like a William Faulkner or a Flannery O'Connor, you're talking about art. But for the most part, I think for most of us, what we have to learn and what we have to work at is the craft.
Right. One of my biggest heroes and influences in writing is Ray Bradbury, and mm-hmm. he was a huge proponent of that very thing, you know, sitting down in his case at the typewriter each week and writing through short stories, and he, you know, all the writing advice I've ever seen him give, he told people write short stories, do one every week, and you know it's almost impossible to go 52 weeks without having a good story come out. You know, it's just that you know, just honing the craft. It's getting better and better, and realizing what your you know, mistakes that you make, but more than that, it's just putting sentences together, getting the story out. That just it just takes time to do it. How do you feel?
If I could just interject very quickly.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, Ray Bradbury was one of my favorite writers, and one of my favorite books of all time is The Martian Chronicles. I mean, aside from that, it's got this fantastic ending. That last paragraph just gets you, you know, right around the throat. But you know, it's one of the great books of all American literature is considered to be Winesburg, Ohio. And when you look at The Martian Chronicles, it's Winesburg, Ohio on Mars.
It is.
So it's Winesburg, Mars. You know, you have these interrelated, interconnected short stories with characters repeating from story to story, yet many times each one is a standalone story. It's real. For anybody who aspires to be a writer, Martian Chronicles should be on their list.
I completely agree. And yeah, there's something magical about taking those collection of stories that loosely connected, and then you know, finding the narrative thread, mm-hmm. and then it's just magical. Did writing short stories for you? Do you feel like that time writing short stories has affected the way that you write now, and the types of things you write now? Do they differ in the writing process from writing short stories?
Well, short stories, an advantage to me of short stories when I was younger is that there was a beginning and a middle of an end within a short period of time. When I was, you know, starting out in my life and occupations and post-college and things like that, I could not write full-time. That was not my occupation. I was always writing, but I had to have a day job. I had sometimes a day job and a night job. And so my time was limited. So short stories was a way to keep writing. But, you know, it was impossible for me to think about embarking on a project like a novel that could take years to complete. I mean, I eventually did do that. But so short stories to me was a way to try and become a better writer within the means that was practical, that I could reach for and grasp. And also, I think what I liked about it is each time you started one, you were starting, in most cases, with a new character, with a new setting, with a new time period. You know, each world you created was a small world for that short story, as opposed to, you know, the mighty planet that a novel or nonfiction book represented. So, but then, you know, that helped me. But I was a journalist and a reporter for years, and I think that helped me too in a different way, because especially when you write for newspapers and magazines, which not as many people do today, but you have to tell your story. Now, it's supposed to be a true one. You have to tell your story within a finite amount of space and words. And that I found very helpful, too. I mean, that goes back to people like Hemingway having done that also, having started out as reporters. I mean, Tom Harris was a reporter for years before he turned to writing books like, you know, Black Sunday and things like that, and Silence of the Lambs. So that I found very helpful, because you had to keep rewriting sentences to get them down to their very essence and not waste space and words and time. So I think when I started to write full-length books, I think the combination of short story experience and journalism experience really helped me be prepared for it. I didn't publish my first book, was not published until I was on the cusp of 40, which probably worked out fine, because I just don't think I was ready to do something competent, a book-length competent project, when I was in my 20s and early 30s.
Yeah, I agree. There's just something about earning a little seasoning in life, isn't
mm-hmm.
there? Yeah.
Not that I wouldn't have minded publishing something when I was 25 and being
sure.
an immediate success, but I remember when a book of mine, Dodge City, came out in 2017, and it came out immediately, got to the New York Times bestseller list. It was on independent booksellers list and everything. And I remember an acquaintance coming up to me and saying, "How does it feel to be an overnight success?" And I said, "Well, it feels good." I said, "But that night lasted 30 years."
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
That was one heck of a night.
That was a long night.
Well, I know you mentioned that you worked in the newspaper business as a reporter, a journalist, and also a publisher, I think, right? Or editor-in-chief?
I worked as editor-in-chief of a chain of newspapers, of weekly newspapers, and before that I was with the New York Times for 15 years, and I'd always been, even as a freelancer, freelancing for newspapers and magazines for quite a few years.
I've met a lot of authors who spent a lot of time in journalism and reporting, and I'm always fascinated by the tools that you pick up along the way in working in journalism. Is it as simple as a journalist has to look at the world differently to be able to capture the story that the rest of us don't see? What is it that you think that you acquire as a journalist that then makes you a better fiction or narrative nonfiction writer?
I do think you become more attentive to detail because when you're right, you have to mute your imagination. And I think that's one of the reasons why you find it very difficult to find somebody who had a successful career as a journalist or nonfiction person, and also as a novelist. I mean, you could count on one hand probably the people who have been very successful doing both in their careers. And part of it, because I think if you're dealing with nonfiction, which certainly journalism is, or very much is supposed to be,
right. You know, it may be questionable these days.
Yeah, some people question that, which is sad for the industry. But
sure.
But you do have to mute your imagination. You have to turn it down, because you can't look at something and start filling in details. you have to look at something and absorb the details that already exist, because you have to, the story that you're going to tell your readers or viewers or listeners or whoever today is, it's got to be as factual as possible. And so you don't have the luxury of saying, you know, well, I'm going to fill in this canvas with my imagination. That canvas better be a very realistic painting or a photograph. You're translating that photograph of what you saw and observed, in addition to whatever you may have researched and interviews you may have done, into as realistic and as authentic a story as possible for your readers and viewers and listeners. So I think that's been a major difference. But that, I found that in turn became very, very helpful when doing nonfiction books. I've had short stories published. I've never had a novel published, not for want of trying, but I never got to that summit of the mountain. But I was remembering when I was doing a book called The Heart of Everything That Is, and you know, being on the trail of the Lakota Sioux leader Red Cloud and spending weeks and going through Nebraska and the Dakotas and Wyoming and going out to the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation where he's buried and where his family still lives. And even though we're talking about a century apart, there's still details about being on that reservation and about the Lakota Sioux people that have a resonance and a relevance to today and have a relevance and a resonance to what they were like in the 1860s and 1870s. And, you know, if I was writing a novel about Red Cloud, some of that material could be imagined. I could color it in with a paintbrush, but the book would not have worked, I think, and I don't think it would have been as well received as it was if it had been inauthentic, if people had thought, oh, he just made this story up.
Right. You mentioned, Tom, that publishing your first book around age 40. What was that story that you found that became this book? How did that thing get started?
Well, it found me, and one of the things
Those are the best.
I know. One of the things that I suggest to aspiring writers, this is mostly going to be true, I think, of people that are looking to you know, be nonfiction writers. It's a different algorithm if you're a fiction writer. But is if you get a chance to collaborate with somebody, if you get a chance to be a ghostwriter, if you get a chance to be a co-writer, even if your name is in very tiny type at the bottom of the cover of the book, it's on the cover of the book, and you get a chance to get a foot in the door. And I had been doing, I was a father of young children myself at the time, and there was a magazine called Child Magazine, and I was writing regularly for them, and they assigned me to do a story about how young children begin to acquire their feelings about people of other colors. What is it? What are subtle things that perhaps parents translate or transmit to them that they're not even aware of when you encounter somebody who's of a different skin color or culture? And I interviewed this African-American husband and wife team of psychologists, and we just seemed to hit it off. And they had an agent, and they had been asked to write this book, but they're not writers. So they asked me if I would come aboard and collaborate with them, which I did. And so that book was published, called Raising the Rainbow Generation, about the idea of we're in a more increasingly multicultural society. How do you raise children in that society so they can get along with people of other colors and cultures? And then we did a second book together, and from there I started to actually get approached by people saying, listen, I'm also an expert in something, and could you write a book with me? So really, the first, I think, three or four books that I did were books where it was, you know, by so-and-so, and they would say, and or with Tom Klavan. And that was fine, because it got me an agent. It got me a bit of a reputation. It got me some paychecks. It got me contracts. And experience, of course. And so from there, I was able to, when the time came, I was able to pitch my first idea on my own. And I had some credibility by then, which most people don't have when they're pitching their very first book.
That's amazing. So what was that first book that you did on your own?
Let's see, that's a good question. The very first book that I remember doing on my own was a biography of a golfer named Walter Hagen. And he's not known today, because his heyday was in the 1910s and 20s into the 30s, but he was really the first professional golfer, meaning that he's the first one who was able to make a living as a golfer, and in a lot of ways created the what we know today as the PGA Tour. And when he retired, he did so having won 14 majors, which is a record that stood for decades until Jack Nicklaus broke it. And he's a very flamboyant character and party bon vivant guy. He'd step up to the first tee of a tournament and have a waiter bring him a martini, which he would down before he hit the first shot. You don't see players like that anymore.
Fantastic.
He was really an act, and in addition to having to be enormously talented. And so it was a lot of fun to write that book, and that was the first one. And Simon & Schuster published it. That was my own. Just had it wasn't so and so with Tom Clavin. It was by Tom Clavin, and that was very satisfying.
Oh, that's a
and
good feeling.
And it was called Sir Walter. You know, Walter Hagen and the inventor of professional golf.
Right, and Walter Hagen was to golf what Babe Ruth was to baseball.
Exactly. And that's a comparison I make in the book because. You know, he was a larger-than-life character who put the sport on his shoulders. And as he became more famous and renowned and world-renowned, I mean, he was the one that introduced Japan to golf, and Japan is now crazy about golf. it elevated the entire sport.
That is amazing. After spending so much time in newspaper and magazine publishing, there are opportunities, I'm sure, to do longer feature pieces, more biographical stuff from time to time, longer than just, you know, a couple of column inches that you normally get to write. How does writing a full biography like that expand on what you already were getting to do? But was it like being free to go as deep as you want to against the constraints of the newspaper business and more periodical publishing? Can you kind of contrast what that's like, getting to have the shackles off and just write the way you want to write?
Well, I enjoy to this day, still when I get a chance, isn't that often, writing for newspapers, for example. And I've always enjoyed it and still do. I enjoy the constraints of newspaper writing. Because I think, to my mind, from a very selfish perspective, as long as you continue to enjoy the restraints of newspaper writing, it still means that you care about telling whatever the story is you're telling as accurately and as concisely as possible, and still be trying to entertain or maybe inform or keep your reader involved. So I still enjoy that. So it wasn't like I was breaking free of shackles that had restrained me and, you know, made me feel like, oh, I'm toiling away down here in the dungeon. But having said that, I did enjoy the idea of exercising completely different muscles. And it's certainly not original for me to say that, you know, a short story, newspaper article, magazine article, even to some extent today, you know, website articles, are a sprint compared to the marathon that is writing an entire book. And, you know, so a couple of differences is, one, the stamina to stay with a project that could take 2, 3, sometimes 4 years, and always have this hope that there is light at the end of the tunnel and you'll eventually reach the end of that tunnel. And I think also the if you're writing a full-length book, when I was writing the book Wild Bill, about Wild Bill Hickok, you know, a newspaper or magazine or website-length piece would have been just him being Marshal of Abilene, Kansas, when that was a town where people were shooting each other in the streets and Wild Bill comes to town to tame it. So that's a fun article right there. You could do a couple of 2,000-3,000 words just writing about that. And I did. The only thing is, that's only, you know, 2% or 3% of the book. Yeah, you have to have all these other episodes, all these other events in Hickok's life. And then you have to not only provide that much research and write about, provide that much information, but the other thing I had to learn was, how do you stitch all this together? You know, you can't have it seem like it's episodic. You know, and then he did this, and then he did this, and then he did this. You know, it has to flow from one thing to another. His childhood, being the child of abolitionist parents and being with his father on the Underground Railroad and you know, secreting escaped slaves of the North has to flow into him being a spy behind Confederate lines during the Civil War, and has to flow into him being an Army scout and all these other adventures that in Calamity Jane, other adventures that he had, so that by the end of the book, people are not saying, "Boy, I'm glad that's over." It was like pounding on my head, one thing after another. They have to say that was a good story, as if you had written a story of 3,000
exactly.
words. Instead, you had written a story of 100,000 words. You still want them to say, "Gosh, that was a good story. I enjoyed that."
Well, you've gone on to tackle some iconic topics, everything from Valley Forge to the book that you wrote with Bob Drury. You've tackled the Vietnam War with the.
Mm-hmm.
You've
Last
tackled
Man Out, yeah.
Last Man Out, Pearl Harbor with Lucky 666, Dodge City, Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson, The Wickedest Town, The American West. Very, very iconic topics that you mention or topics that you mention to a lot of people, and they'll at least have a recollection, and a lot of times they'll think they know what the story is. But you go, and like you said with Wild Bill, you look for those things that we don't know so readily, and you find the narrative thread in those so that it is, becomes a great story that you don't want to end instead of just a list of bullet points that you pound us over the head with. In doing the research, how do you scratch past the surface and get to the story that we don't know, but that you know is going to capture our imagination?
Well, this is going to kind of sound kind of cynical, but it's not hard to get past the surface. It's just that there have been too many writers that haven't bothered, they're okay with the surface, the low hanging fruit, the easily found and digestible facts. To write a book like Wild Bill about Hickok, you could just repeat the legends. 75% of them are not true, but you can still stitch a book together about stuff that's not true. So to get past in the research to go back to any original reporting done on Hickok during his lifetime, which there was done, to track down and find the letter writers. I mean, thank goodness this man was a letter writer to his family back in Illinois. To when he fell in love, he would write letters back for years back and forth to the woman he was in love with, and they would, that correspondence is not all of it, but a lot of that correspondence is still available. He would write to siblings, so you have that original material. You have things that were written by other people, some of which you have to get rid of because it's just not authentic, some of which they kept good journals in which Wild Bill, they knew Wild Bill, and here's some of the encounters that they had. So that material is available. You just have to scratch harder under the surface to find it, and then delightfully find, and in the cases of some of the books that I've worked on, that the real stories are just as entertaining as or more so than the stuff that was invented. And it's sort of like guilt-free reading for people. It's okay to read and enjoy it and know that it's true. You don't have to feel guilty that you're reading something that's not true. It's true. So another example is a book that I did that I'm very fond of called Reckless. There is a story called War Horse, which originally I think was a play and then became a movie that Steven Spielberg directed. It's a good movie. And it's about a horse that was with the British in World War One. It's a good story. It's totally invented. It's total fiction. I mean, nobody pretends that it's not fiction. It's a fictional story. Reckless, there really was a war horse. There really was a horse who fought with the U.S. Marine Corps in Korea and was actually a Marine and retired as a sergeant, the only four-legged Marine in the Corps' history. And to go burrowing down and find this material, to thankfully still find people that served with Reckless, served with a horse, slept in the same tent with the horse in 1953, to interview them and get their experiences. Gosh, that was fun. And what a remarkable story Reckless is. And it's a real, true war horse.
Well, like you said, that sometimes the truth is more entertaining, more engaging than the legends that have been passed mm-hmm. on. Because we know that it's true, and it seems to, when we know something is true and we see these characters that are larger than life, it resonates in a different way with us. Why do you think it is that we as a society are happy to just regurgitate the same legends that have been inflated when the true history is so much better?
Well, you know, I think part of it is something that's it's comforting to us. You know, especially if you get to be a certain age. I mean, just I think about when my three best friends are fellas that I've known since we were in third grade together. So we've known each other for half a century, and we don't get together that often, maybe a couple of times a year because we live in different parts of the country, but we make a point of doing so. And one of the things we love to do is we tell stories that are reminiscences of when we were kids and teenagers and other things. Now, you know, can I guarantee you that everything that we say in those stories to each other is the truth? No, of course not. They've been, over the years, have been embellished. They've been changed. Our memories have betrayed us to a certain extent. They're still good stories, but I can't tell you if a story that we're going to see each other this summer. I can't guarantee you the stories we tell each other this summer are going to be the same stories we told each other 20 years ago. You know? However, we laugh. They give us comfort of these shared experiences. They make us feel good about our friendship and about how long it's lasted, and about each one of us personally. We just feel better about ourselves that we're in this friendship relationship that's so important to us. And I think to some extent that's our relationship with stories about the American past, that there's stories about, especially about the American West, which is sort of like our Iliad and Odyssey, the tales that have come down from the American West. And so we're okay, many of us, with telling those same stories over and over again and not being too concerned about how much of them are actual fact. And there's that great line from you know, the John Ford movie, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, when legend becomes the fact, print the legend. You know, we're okay with the legend. And what I'm saying, and I've had the good fortune in several of the books that I've written or co-written with Bob Drury, that the stories that are based more on facts can be just as, if not more, like you use the word engaging, I think that's a really good word, engaging and authentic and enjoyable as what the legends are.
You've written several books about the American West, The Heart of Everything That Is, Dodge City, and now Wild Bill. When you start uncovering the legends and these characters that are larger than life, and a lot of these that we've, you know, kind of iconized, you know, and we hold them in a certain esteem. When you start really getting down to the truth of the person that you're dealing with, is it tough to tell things about a character that, you know, that people have a certain idea of? And then, you know, it's like none of us could ever live up to the legend that becomes, because people are three-dimensional people. Some days they're wonderful people. Some days they're not. Some, you know, we all make decisions, that we're not proud of. When you start, you know, making these into real people again, instead of just these legends, you know, are you ever careful about how you portray people? What are some of the criteria that you start going through when building a story about these folks?
Well, the only criteria I think is to just be as accurate as possible, and even if that includes a warts and all portrayal. I just think it's more fun, more interesting, if you have these three-dimensional people that you're not just portraying them as in black and white terms. You know, you look at somebody like Wyatt Earp, and he was obviously one of the two prominent characters in the book Dodge City, the other one being Bat Masterson. You know, we have for movies and television shows and countless novels about the American West that Wyatt Earp was this, you know, for the most part, this upstanding representative of law and order, a marshal of Dodge City, marshal of Tombstone, neither of which is true. And that he was an upstanding guy who was the representative of law and order in the American West. Some of that is indeed true. But, you know, when you flesh out the rest of his life, you know, he had, when he was a young man and he had been married very young and his first wife tragically died and he was on this, you know, this tailspin of grief and he became a criminal. You know, he was getting arrested for things, and even so seriously as being found and convicted of being a horse thief and sent to prison. And when, you know, Wyatt Earp, when he escaped, I mean, he was a jailbird. He was a wanted man, and he did have an opportunity to turn the corner and start getting on a more straight and narrow path. But I think when you find out about Wyatt Earp's criminal past, I think that makes him a more interesting character. That he was more human than you know, it was almost by sheer luck that he ended up becoming a lawman. Again, never ascended to as high as being marshal of any town, but he was a lawman who ended up playing a prominent role in Dodge City and certainly in Tombstone. His brother Virgil was actually the marshal. So that makes it a lot more you know, interesting to me to tell the story about these characters where you do see them as three-dimensional. And as human beings, with Bat Masterson, for example, he's thought of as a lawman and a gambler and other people, whatever else he was. And yet you find out that he spent the last 15 years of his life as a New York City newspaper reporter and man about town. And he loved to write about the three things that began with B that he loved the most: boxing, baseball, and Broadway. And he was a celebrity in New York City. Who knew about that? But that made for a fact, and you know, one of his proteges, a man who just worshipped him, was a young reporter named Damon Runyon, and Runyon would eventually write a collection of stories about New York in the 19-teens and 1920s that got turned into the musical Guys and Dolls, who's the main character, Skye Masterson, which was his tribute to his pal and mentor, Bat Masterson. So I think when you find out more of these real facts about the characters, it just makes it all the more interesting to be able to include that in those stories.
One thing that you learn in uncovering the story, and especially like what you were just telling us about Bat Masterson, I didn't know that. That's fantastic.
Uh-huh.
But we hold this time that we think of as the Wild West. It was really a narrow point of history, wasn't it? It was just a few years, but they're so legendary in our minds.
It is. When you consider, I mean, what we normally consider the Wild West would be after the Civil War, and really it was over by the 1880s. I think there was even an act of Congress that declared the frontier was closed. You know, there was no place left that we had not designated, or, you know, either was federal land, state land, county. You know, counties had been formed, cities had been incorporated. There was no, I mean, west of the Missouri River in the 1840s and 50s used to be, and it's on actual maps, was referred to as the Great American Desert, because there was so much we didn't know about what's out there. And yet by the 1880s, we knew, you know, we knew about it. There had been telegraph lines for years. The railroad had united the both coasts. Even in Tombstone, when the Earps and the Clantons were having at it in Tombstone, there was the first telephone. Was you know, when there was a stagecoach robbery, one of the survivors of the robbery made it to a nearby little mine complex and phoned Tombstone to tell the sheriff that they had just been robbed. So it really is a pretty finite period of time there, from, you know, the late 1860s to the early to mid 1880s. By then, too, another reason why the frontier was considered closed is that there were no more free-ranging Indian tribes. They had either been virtually exterminated or were all confined to reservations. You know, when Geronimo finally surrendered for the last time in 1886, that was essentially it, you know. And so we don't, when you think about it, we don't have as many characters, important characters who represent the Wild West as we could have had if that period of time had been longer. You know, we have, you talk about the so-called good guys. You have a Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson, Wild Bill Hickok, and, you know, maybe two, Buffalo Bill Cody, maybe two or three others, Calamity Jane, Annie Oakley, and we have some bad guys, the James Brothers and the Doolin Gang and some of the others, and Billy the Kid, of course. So I think what some of the challenge has been for people is that you have only a certain number of characters, and yet you have to find ways to write about it that is still going to be not only just entertaining but illuminating. What's new that you can find out? You know, like a Bat Masterson, that he was a newspaper reporter, and he wrote his whole life about the people he associated with. That Wyatt Earp, in his later years, he lived in Los Angeles, and he was a consultant to a silent film director of Westerns named John Ford. You know, you can always find out, if you dig deep enough, there's always more interesting things to find out about these characters, who we all think we know everything about them already, but we don't. If you look hard enough, there's more to find.
Well, which brings us to Wild Bill, the new book, the story of American Frontier's first gunfighter. What was it about Wild Bill's story that piqued your imagination and made you want to dig deeper?
You know, it was one of those things where Dodge City had come out, and I was actually under contract to do it. I was already working on another book, which was the World War II story. But Dodge City, you know, thanks Zeus or whoever, was very successful right out of the gate. And so my editor said, you know, would you consider putting the book you're working on aside for now? Is there another iconic character from that basic time period that we could give the same approach to, which is, what don't we know about this character? Like there's so much we did know about Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson and Dodge City. And my immediate thought was Wild Bill. I did find that there had not been a biography of him since 1964, which was slightly revised in 1974. But my thought was, if Hickok turns out to be, from my initial research, no more than a gunfighter, I don't know that I want to do that book. It's so one-dimensional to me. I mean, yeah, it's kind of interesting that he was, you know, basically the first gunfighter of the American West and the best. And, you know, he died basically the undefeated, undisputed champ of gunfighters in the West. But I don't know if I want to do a whole book about somebody who's that confined. But if there's more, and that's what was so much fun about working on James Butler Hickok, because you find out this unusual childhood as helping slaves to escape from the South and the Civil War spy. And yes, he was a lawman. He was also a federal marshal. He was an Army scout. He was a Broadway stage actor, circus performer, gambler, gold prospector. I mean, he was all these other lives that he led and squeezed it into 39 years. And that was to me what I found most fascinating, that he had all these lives, and it was kind of a tragic one too, because he, you know, by the time he died, the West was starting to pass him by, and he was not equipped to make that adjustment to a modern American West. He was very much a product of the classic, using that word, American West that we're more familiar with.
Well, and a tragic demise that it was. I didn't realize he was only 39 when he passed. That's incredible that the amount of life that he crammed into 39 years makes me seem lazy.
And then to find out too that he was going blind, you know,
right.
That would have been kind of a drawback to a gunfighter.
Sure.
I think, to not be able to see. So it's tragic that he was killed at only 39 and killed from behind, which is the only way somebody was going to get him. And not completely unexpected, at least from his point of view. He had a premonition that something was going to happen to him. But it was, you kind of think that what would life have been for him if he had lived longer, lived into his 40s, but as somebody who had lost the ability, had lost his sight. So it's almost like, you don't want to say this necessarily about somebody who dies at 39, but it was almost like the appropriate time for him to die, because he was not able to, I think, physically and mentally prepare himself for what the rest of the 1870s was going to be like, the 1880s. And so by dying young, he also sort of like guaranteed that he was always going to be that fascinating and tragic figure in American history.
Well, if there was ever a man for his time, it was Wild Bill, that's for sure.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Well, the new book is out everywhere in hardcover, Kindle edition, audiobook. The book is fantastic, Tom. Is there a place where people can find you if they want to dig into your back catalog, learn more about what's going on, and follow you along?
I do have a website. I wish I kept up with it more than I do. I mean, I kept up with it with whenever I publish a new book, but I need to become more disciplined about using it. It's tomclavin.com, TomClavin.com, tomclavin.com. And I know some people use their websites to engage more with their readers, and I want to do that. I've just been so busy writing to meet recent deadlines that I haven't had much energy left over to deal with the website. But it is a good website. I like it. It has all the books listed. People can purchase the books on the website, and my contact information was there. That's how, you know, I frequently hear from people, and it's because they went on the website and they found my email address. And you know, even so, you know, somebody will contact me. I've had people contact me from Wyoming and say, "Oh, my great-great-grandfather says that he, you know, once told a story about watching Wild Bill Hickok give a shooting exhibition in Kansas."
Wow!
So it's cool to get that feedback from readers.
Absolutely. Well, and when you're turning out books like you are, we appreciate that you're spending that time.
Oh, my pleasure.
Tom, I know that Wild Bill is out now, and it's probably been off your desk for quite a while as it goes through the publishing process. What are you working on now?
Well, you know, inadvertently, this is becoming a Frontier Lawman trilogy. And by that,
nice.
I mean, you know, Dodge City had been written first, but it's actually going to be number second in this trilogy, going in chronological order. You have Wild Bill Hickok, the Wild Bill book will be first in the trilogy, and he really was the prototype of the first kind of lawman in the American West, the one who wore the two guns and could shoot the outlaws before the outlaws could shoot back. Then he had that transition period in Dodge City with Wyatt Earp and Bat Masterson, and then I'm just finishing a book called On Tombstone that is sort of like the end of the frontier lawman in a lot of ways, because we have Wyatt, you have Doc Holliday, but it's more about the Earp brothers too, Virgil and Morgan. And Virgil came to represent the police officer or the marshal that was making that transition. While Virgil was marshal of Tombstone, the police department was created, and he stopped being a marshal and became the police commissioner or chief of police. And that became the prototype for what more modern law enforcement was going to be, not just, you know, on the American frontier and in the American West. So I think this trilogy, when Tombstone will appear next, I think March or April, let's say March for now. And when that's done, there'll be this trilogy of Wild Bill, Dodge City, and Tombstone. That's going to be this frontier lawman trilogy that I'd never envisioned when I first wrote page one of Dodge City, but it sort of became this organically evolved to this point. And I think it's, you know, when all is said and done, it's going to be a very interesting saga. It's going to end up being, you know, something like 1,000 words that is about not only just about these iconic figures and the other iconic figures they encountered, but this transition of the American frontier from a very lawless place to where it started to see itself as a place of, you know, here's where you raise a family, where you build your churches and schools, and start looking at the dawn of the 20th century.
Incredible. I can't wait to see that. Tom, when that book comes out, will you please come back and talk with us about it?
My pleasure. You know my number.
Absolutely. Tom, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Thank you. It's been a privilege.
Thanks for listening to the Author Stories Podcast. For more great author interviews like this one, go to hankgarner.com and dig through the archives. There's something there I know you'll love. Now stay tuned for a special audio clip from Richard Gleaves' The Jason Crane Series.
They reverently slipped Jason's giant-size X-Men number 1 from its Mylar protector. Drinking in the sweet aroma of browning paper and three-color process that signals only the best and rarest and most wonderful of collectibles. On one page, Professor X raised his fingers to his temples and rallied his X-Men, his psychic commands radiating from his bald head like waves off hot asphalt. "I have psychic powers," Owen blurted. "I want Wolverine's claws." Jason was turning a page. "Snicked! Or, hey, get this. Lightsabers poking out the backs of my hands. Or even, no, I'm totally serious. I have psychic powers." "No, you don't." "I do." Jason laid the comic on the bedspread. He sighed. Owen could be such a spaz sometimes. Okay, he said indulgently. What number am I thinking of? Stop! It doesn't work that way. What I can do is called a psychic reading, off an object, like getting impressions. When the doorbell rings, if I put my hand on the knob, as soon as I do, I know who's there. It's called looking through the peephole, moron. Shut up! And when I touch the phone, I know who's calling. I'm sure, Mr. Bullshit from Bullshit Mountain. Like my sister or my grandmother, I just know it's them. There's no such thing as psychics. Okay, you try. Don't be stupid. Are you chicken? Fine! Okay. He snatched up a brown paper bag, spotted with grease, and dumped a few stale French fries into the trash can. I'll put an object in this bag, and you try to guess what it is. Turn your back. Jason did, and heard a rustling behind his head. Okay, you can look now. Owen produced the bag. It was rounded with some object now. Don't touch yet. Just think. Try to imagine what's inside. Your lunch? Jason sneered, but he closed his eyes and tried to imagine. He could hear Owen's breathing. Jason's nose itched. His brain grew bored with nothing to look at, and fragments of images swam in and out of his imagination. Strawberry, he blurted. Owen reached into the bag, producing a white bowl. Jason had eaten frosted flakes from it about 3 days ago. A few stuck to it, like little beige fish scales. See? I lose. No, look here. Owen pointed. A design went around the sides of the bowl. A long string of vines and painted fruit. With strawberries. That's... Jason began, but didn't know how to end the sentence. It's cool. See? What did I tell you? Do it again. Jason closed his eyes. An image like daisies and sun and... Yellow, he blurted after 3 seconds. Oh my God, open your eyes! Owen held a bright yellow highlighter pen. I hadn't even put it in the bag! And so they went, for 30 minutes or more. A staple remover, a toy soldier, a sweat sock, a pencil. Jason never said precisely what was in the bag, but it was always close or related. He'd imagine a cockpit, and Owen would produce a game controller. He'd say plate, and the object would be a CD. He made right angles with his pointer fingers, shrugging, only to have Owen pull out Eliza's knitting needles. His friend became more and more enthusiastic, but Jason became a little scared. You have a real gift, Owen said. You're, like, brilliant. Owen babbled for a long time about astral projection and ESP, how Jason was picking up signals from Owen's own psychic powers, which had obviously been doing the broadcasting. Owen left that night full of plans and experiments, vindicated in his beliefs. Jason sat on the bed after Owen left, thinking hard. He had no explanation for what he'd done, but he knew he hadn't faked it. He couldn't believe, but he couldn't deny, either.